Welcome to All Sides with Anna Staver. When Jennifer Natalia Fink was 7, she remembers searching her grandparents' Long Island home for photos of a cousin, a boy that she had never met. She knew that he had something called Down syndrome, that he was separated from the family at birth. But that was the extent of what she knew about the cousin she came to call XY. Jennifer's cousin was one of thousands of children who were sent away, hidden at institutions, away from fans and family, and sometimes never acknowledged again. We're talking about those children this hour, the history of institutionalizing those born different, and the future of kinship care. And we begin with Jennifer Natalia Fink, who is now a professor of English and Disability Studies at Georgetown University, where she co-founded and directs the Disability Studies Program. She's the author of a book, All Our Families, Disability Lineage and the Future of Kinship. Welcome to All Sides, Jennifer.
Thank you so much, Anna. I'm so happy to be here.
What sparked this idea for me was an article in The Atlantic written by another Jennifer, Jennifer Senior, and it was titled The Ones We Sent Away. And she wrote about her own family, this aunt that she never knew she had, who is now in her 70s. And she wrote something that I want to explore with you. She writes, "It's extraordinary what we hide from ourselves, and even more extraordinary that we once hid her, my mother's sister, and so many like her, from everyone." I have to ask, it feels like something we did so long ago, and yet it's so very recent.
Yes, and to some extent, both the legacy and actually the sending away continues. So I would argue that while the mass institutionalization has ended, there still is over-institutionalization, especially of adults with disabilities. And the legacy continues even though the practice has ended, largely.
You know, one of the lines that you've written about this that really got me was that a ghost in the family fiction. And I love that line because it does feel kind of what we're describing, someone that you know exists and at the same time doesn't exist for you.
Yes, that's exactly right. And I think our families are haunted by these absent presences of disabled people. So my cousin I never met was disappeared, not just from the family, but from the narrative, the story the family told about itself, the fiction of family. And I think this is just as important as the sort of horrific fact of mass institutionalization, which most of us would say, oh, that's terrible. And thank God that's not happening anymore. But we continue to excise, delineate disabled people from our understanding of our family histories and hence our families in the present day. And that's really why I wrote this book. And what I'm trying to communicate is not just that this mass institutionalization happened, which was absolutely horrific, but that we continue, even if we don't literally excise disabled people from our family, we excise them from our understanding of family and what a normal family is, even though 1 in 5 people in the world, according to the World Health Organization, are disabled, which means disabled people are the largest minority group in the world, which means all of us have disabled people in all of our families.
Yeah, I find it so interesting. And sometimes I think it's perfectly innocent in the sense that you may go your whole life, you may get to adulthood, and then suddenly in conversation with a parent or a grandparent as an adult, they mention this other kid and you have to be like, well, hold the phone. What do you mean other kid?
Right, right. And that's, and Jennifer Senior articulates perfectly how that happens. And that's the ghosting I'm talking about. You can't actually destroy a person without consequences, it turns out, right? And not just consequences, obviously, to that person, but to the whole family, to the whole family system. And there's an irony here in that one of the arguments for mass institutionalization, and this was said to my family, this was said to Jennifer Senior's family, this was probably said to your family, that not only is this for the best for the disabled person, but it's the best for the family and especially for the siblings of that child. And it turns out to be both sociologists and just regular humans narrating their experience, like Jennifer Senior and I, can tell you that's absolutely false. It's absolutely the opposite. It's devastating to the whole family system.
Yeah, it's not just everyday people with hidden relatives, but famous playwrights like Arthur Miller doesn't really mention his son Daniel, who was institutionalized. He's left out of his memoir. His obituary names three children instead of four. So people, famous people, regular everyday people, and everyone in between has these missing relatives.
Absolutely. And Arthur Miller's case is so poignant and tragic and really points to the heart of this, which is that Arthur Miller never visited his son. He abandoned him to a horrific institution, actually. He didn't understand his son to be an individual or a human. And this was not because he lacked the resources to care for him, right? This was a wealthy, famous person. But the stigma and shame and dehumanization were so profound that even Arthur Miller excised, delineated is the term I've come to use, his own son from the story of his family, from the story he told about his family, and the story the larger culture ultimately told about him. And this wasn't because I think Arthur Miller was a terrible person. I don't think my relatives were terrible people. Jennifer Senior's family are not terrible people. But this was the norm, and its violence we're only beginning to reckon with.
Yeah, in preparation for this episode, I was having this conversation with my mother, and she told me that before my aunt married my uncle, her brother, she was married before, and she had a daughter who was sent away. And I was like, "Excuse me, what?" Because I've known
Yeah.
this aunt my whole life.
Right.
And she had this other life before she married my uncle, which is like, okay, people have other lives. I just didn't know that she had an adult daughter who was still alive, who she occasionally goes and sees. And I'm like, "Excuse me?"
Yeah, it's amazing, right? And how this is normalized. And, you know, what we
And
need to
nobody thought to
come.
mention it, I guess. It's just
Right,
not the
right.
thing.
Yeah, and those omissions are intentional, I think, because the fantasy is that if we don't talk about it, if we send these people, quote unquote, away, that somehow they don't exist. Somehow disability doesn't exist, right? So I think that's the fantasy that we're still perpetuating, this ableist fantasy that disability is horrific and terrible and that it's abnormal. Right, even though it's absolutely ordinary, and that we would rather pretend it doesn't exist and wreak really horrific consequences to disabled people and their families rather than integrate disability into our understanding of family and what's normal.
We also want to hear from you this hour. Do you have a story of someone who was sent away? You can give us a call at 614-292-8513, or if you would prefer, you can email all sides at wosu.org. One of the things you write that I find fascinating is that it was so difficult for you to learn about your cousin, about who you call XY, because there's no legal right to know about these people. The parents, I guess, essentially relinquish those rights to whomever ends up taking care of them.
Yes, that's exactly right. This disappearing was legal. and it was very hard to find. in one sense, what had happened to him. And then in another way, it was there all the time, extremely accessible. So I really encourage everyone to push against this fiction. If you think there is a disabled person who was institutionalized, they weren't sent away. They were sent into horrific institutions. Where were they sent? That institution has a record. Somebody knows about them, right? They may still be alive. If they died, there's a death record, right? So I think there's a doubleness to this. It was both impossible in one sense and incredibly easy in another, right? In my book, I have tips for how do you find your disability lineage. The book is an argument for why you should, right? But then there's the how. And one thing is just to start having the kind of conversation, Anna, that you had with your mother. Start talking about it. Look in those photograph albums for the people who nobody wants to talk about. Oh, that's Uncle Earl. We don't talk about him. Right. And then they're public records. They really are. Because this language of sent away or not part of our family anymore. They were sent somewhere and something happened to them, and they are individuals, even if they've passed, worthy of their story being recuperated, because it will not only dignify them, it will help transform your understanding of disability as it lives in the present, in your life, in your community, in your family.
I wonder how you see this practice fitting into some of the larger cultural contexts of, say, for example, we used to send pregnant, unwed mothers away to have their babies and forcibly give them up for adoption. Or we used to send women we found to be troubling or irritating away and institutionalize them for as long as, say, their husbands, fathers, partners felt was necessary.
Yeah, I mean, I think it's a part of that larger mass institutionalization, but it is wound around eugenics and fascism in a particular way and has a particular violence that I would argue continues in our present understanding of family and disability as somehow oppositional, a little differently. A lot of our models for this sending a quote unquote sending away, this mass warehousing, institutionalizing, comes from guess who? Why, our friends the Nazis, not somebody whose politics you disagree with, so you're going to call them a Nazi. No, I'm talking about bona fide German fascist Nazis who in 1939, Hitler started the T4 program. T4 stands for Tiergangstrasse 4, in which he sort of piloted the whole death camp mass gassing eugenics program that was so successful later for 8 million people. It actually started with disabled people. And in hospitals and medical clinics, disabled people were brought by their families to be gassed, and they perfected the technique of gassing. And said, anybody who is not going to be a productive laborer should not only not pass on their genes, but they shouldn't exist. And that really is the model of mass institutionalization, that sorting between some people are entitled to live and some people aren't. And that continues, I think, in our mentality today. I also think that when we talk about how this changed, it's important to note that it wasn't because, people just got smarter and kinder or something. It was really the work of disabled people who were activists, like the late great Judith Heumann, who insisted on their right to be integrated into their families, into schools, into the workplace, with huge resistance from the medical establishment. Enormous resistance. So I think that's important to note as well. I think today still, and I talk about this in my book, a parent who receives a diagnosis that a child is disabled experiences it as traumatic, and that's normalized. Everybody says, oh, you should talk to a therapist. Yes, it's so hard. Here's a support group, blah, blah, blah. And I don't mean to minimize the challenges of having a disabled child as a parent of a disabled child. I am very aware of those. But those challenges are largely due to our problematic care system and to ableism. They're not intrinsic to the condition or the child themselves. And I was really confronted with this when my own child was diagnosed at age two with a disability. And there was just this whole melodramatic trauma narrative about it. And I felt that. I'm somewhat embarrassed and ashamed to say. And I also felt, wait, what? My daughter's amazing. She's like the coolest person ever. And I don't experience her as other. I experience her as very similar to me, actually. And the available narratives in the culture just were about trauma and not about the difficulties of care, the difficulties of accessibility, and the profound ableism that comes out of this experience of mass institutionalization that's our inheritance.
I want to take a call from Jay in Columbus because I think it dovetails perfectly with this. Welcome to All Sides, Jay.
Hey, thanks for having me. I would obviously in the past situation, and still to this day, conditions in a lot of these institutions, as we've been talking about, and some of the reasons for sending people away have been really bad. But I'd like to reconcile, or I'd like for our guest possibly to reconcile some of the language that's being used and some of the perspective that's being used with the fact that there are folks who do, you know, because of their disability, need care really outside of a traditional family home, either because of their needs or because of the lack of the ability for the family to take care of them, and that folks can still be honored in that, and you know, maybe reframe it just a little bit with instead of using some of the language we've been using, because I think there is a place for care for folks sometimes in some situations that need alternate care situations. Can we comment on that? Thank you.
Yeah, of course. Jennifer.
Thank you so much for that comment, Jay. I agree with you completely, actually. And I do discuss that in my book. What's emerging now are care systems centered on the needs of the disabled person that include the family, that don't separate the person from their family, even if they have high care needs. And I think there are a range of models that are evolving. But I would add, and there's some very good ones, and I'd ask everybody to look at the Autism Self-Advocacy Network. It has a wonderful white paper on exactly this subject, right? We know the critique of mass institutionalization, but what happens when, say, your family passes, or say, a lot of disabled people don't want to live with their families when they're adults. Why would they? My daughter doesn't, right? So what are the alternatives? And there are emerging some really wonderful ones in my state, Maryland. The neighborhood is one that takes apartment buildings and makes them both units for people who don't identify as having a disability and people who do and need 24-hour care in some cases don't, and has integrated, and that's kind of the key word here, is integrated activities that both communities can partake in and enjoy together. And I think that's really a model. And sometimes people say to me, oh, but that's for people who aren't that disabled. I'm saying, no, actually, there's some people with very high care needs. Who have trouble breathing independently, who have benefited enormously from this. So I think there are some wonderful models emerging. I think, however, the lack of a serious attempt by our government to provide meaningful care throughout the life cycle to disabled people and their families leads people to move towards congregate care. When it's not necessary. So again, I'm not blaming parents or families. There's a systemic problem. And as long as we continue to believe disability is something that happens to other folks, right, and that it's abnormal and unfamiliar and unfamilial, we'll continue down that path. So I think they're two pieces of it happening at the same time.
And if you want to join our conversation, you can give us a call at 614-292-8513. We're going to take a short break, and when we come back, our conversation about the ones we sent away continues on 89.7 NPR News.
New from The Embedded podcast. Female athletes have always needed grit and talent. But for decades, they've also needed a certificate.
There was chit-chat about, is that really a woman?
And even now, they're still being checked and questioned. Their story is the newest series from CBC and NPR's Embedded. It's called Tested. Listen wherever you get your podcasts.
You're listening to All Sides. I'm your host, Anna Staver. We're talking this hour about the history of institutionalization and why so many families kept secrets about the relatives they, quote, sent away. Still with us is Jennifer Natalia Fink, a professor of English and Disability Studies at Georgetown University and the author of the book All Our Families, Disability Lineage and the Future of Kinship. While we were on break, we got a comment on our social media page that from a woman who says, I worked in a New York rehab center years ago where an infant was born with serious malformations and spent her days alone in her crib with only nurses to care and interacted with her. To this day, it haunts me. As a mother of children, I just feel so, I can't imagine not having my baby after it was born. That's its own kind of tragedy, regardless of the circumstances in which it happens.
Yes, and a form of violence to the mother and father as well. Thank you for sharing that horrific and poignant experience. And I think this language of sent away, we really have to interrogate and say, sent away to where? To what conditions? And why? Why was the mother not with that child? Even if that child were going to pass, both the child and the parent have a right to family. I want to bring up a statistic that really startled me, because it really crystallizes this whole issue. Down syndrome is kind of one of the best understood disabilities, right? We know what it is. And there's no medication, no cure, no treatment, actually, right? It's an extra chromosome, diagnosed before birth now, et cetera, et cetera. So we're all familiar with Down syndrome. In 1985, very close to 100% of children born with Down syndrome were institutionalized. Those children received very little education. Most could not read or write and had little speech. And their average lifespan was 28 years. In 2022, when a very small percentage now are institutionalized. People with Down syndrome, about 20% graduate from college. Speech and education, communication and work are the norm. And here's the shocker. The average lifespan with no new medical treatment, no breakthrough on that front, is now 60, more than double. And the scientists and social scientists research this, say it's because of one factor, the difference between growing up in an institution versus a family. And I think that's what we have to kind of hold on to here when we think about this. Are those families perfect? No. Are there stressors? for everybody, right? Sure. But think about that when you think about what it means to mass institutionalize versus the potential for people with disabilities when they are fully integrated into their families and communities.
That is a really stunning statistic, not only in terms of how long they live, but I think about the quality of life that they have.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And, you know, while we're on this day, you know, we will all be disabled if we should live so long, right? We should be so lucky to live long enough to be disabled. So, you know, this is also about projection. We've projected onto disabled people, people who have apparent disabilities, people who are born with disabilities, our own anxieties about human frailty, about the inevitable challenges that come with age, and what does it take for us to stop doing so and to really value the lives of disabled people and our own.
I want to explore that idea of what is, I don't know if the phrasing is correct, what we consider to be an okay disability versus a not okay. And what I mean by that is you and I both wear glasses. My eyes do not work correctly. You know, my father was mostly deaf by the time I was born, but he had hearing aids. He could lip read in a lot. He went to work. He was successful. We sort of consider that to be okay, if that makes sense. There are all these different things. I recently tore my rotator cuff and I'm in physical therapy, but I can't turn my right shoulder at all the way that I used to. And it's driving me bananas. But all of these things are considered okay. I mean, my husband's brother had a hole in his heart when he was born and he was very quickly whisked away and there was surgery and they closed it and he's fine. But
right.
All of those things are considered totally okay.
Right, right. And, you know, a guy named Mike Oliver said, well, it's not really the objective of impairment. We think that it's sort of the degree of the objective impairment, right? Like I wear glasses, you can measure what's, you know, the impairment of my eyes. And it's not really the degree of the impairment, but how it makes us feel about ourselves. So for example, as you noted, Anna, we both wear glasses. I wear glasses, and in my right eye, I am legally blind without my glasses. I see very close to 20/20 with them. And I don't know, do you think I'm disabled? I have a colleague who is a wheelchair user with ramps and accessible buildings, which are the law. She can pretty much do everything I can do. Is she disabled? Why have we decided that I am not disabled when if you did a study of the population, I'm probably in like the lowest 5% for vision in my right eye without glasses, right? She is equally able to access our culture if it's made accessible. Right, but we've decided that people in wheelchairs make us who are not in wheelchairs uncomfortable. So we're going to call them disabled, and we're going to call people in glasses not
disabled.
People
in glasses.
Right, right. So, and you know, this is sometimes called the social model of disability versus the medical model. And it's not, I am about the least woo person you'll ever meet. Don't new age me anything, please. Audience members out there, please don't send me notes about, you know, home cures for autism or any of this. I hate all that stuff. Honestly, my dad's a scientist. I'm a very medically minded person, actually. But the medical model, you know, medicine is a discourse as well as a set of objective practices, says a disability is an individual problem that needs to be cured, and certain kinds are really problems and certain are, as Anna says, okay, right? And the social model says what's disabling isn't really the objective of impairment, but whether or not a society decides it's okay and can make things accessible, right? And until very recently, autistic people were considered not okay. They made non-autistic people very nervous, right? And, you know, in the, I'm really aware of this because I have an autistic child, you know, in the past 10 years, there's been a real shift, not in anything medical again, right? Not even so much in the understanding scientifically. Down syndrome is much better understood than autism, right? So it's not really that there's been this great medical breakthrough or even medical understanding. What's changed is as a society, we've shifted mostly because of the activism of autistic people themselves, right? Saying, you know, we are different and equally valuable, and we want to be valued and included, right? So I think, you know, it's tricky because this way of thinking can start feeling to some people, especially parents, like we're minimizing challenges, you know, that we're kind of saying disability isn't really so disabling, right? And that's part of why I insist on using the word and not, you know, special, that nothing euphemistic, no special this, partly because it's ordinary and common, and partly because it is challenging. And there are inherent challenges in physical differences sometimes, right? However, what makes something toxic, phobic, is really social, not medical. So I think that's the terrain, Anna, that you're sort of negotiating here and thinking about your own family and your own lived experience of your own body, mind. And, you know, I also think we're still not used to all kinds of body minds in all kinds of spaces, right? We still think that disabled people belong over there, and we belong, the not disabled, because we're terrified we might be, belong over here. And nobody would admit to such a segregationist impulse, but it profoundly structures the way these conversations happen, I think.
I want to read an email from Julianne. She writes, in 1949, my mother gave birth to my older brother. After years of worrying about his progress, he was diagnosed with multiple conditions, and my parents were advised to institutionalize him. Instead, they became proactive in advocating for him, sometimes to the unintentional detriment of other children. However, after years of both special education and mainstream education, he graduated from a regular high school 1 year later than expected, and had a successful work career and now retirement. It gave us all more empathy.
Oh, that's beautiful. That's beautiful. And we do have to remember that there were always, usually mothers, there were always those who said no to the doctors. That's why really it was very close to 100% with Down syndrome that were institutionalized, but not 100%, because there were people like you whose parents made a different decision and with such a different outcome, right? And I never want to tell people about their experience, but today there's a lot more support for siblings of children with disabilities, because there are challenges for families and siblings that don't come up in the same way when you don't have a disabled sibling. And I think the children who are not disabled, the siblings, need support and recognition. And I think today that wasn't really understood.
And neither was caregiver burnout, which is a thing.
Right. Absolutely.
And I'm sure there's a ton of guilt associated with that burnout.
Absolutely. And, you know, I didn't plan to write a book about the care system or the structure of kinship in America, right? I just thought I was writing about this one thing, but I ended up discovering that I couldn't really write about this delineation, right, of disabled people, this separation, not just physical, but from the story of a family, right? Without looking at our horrific care system that is profoundly sexist, right? Profoundly underfunded, profoundly racist. Aging Poo has written extensively about this, right? So I think that burnout is really part of a whole structure that is in denial, is ableist, depends on unpaid female labor, underpays people of color doing a lot of the direct care, right? And think we still think of care as something, you know, other people should be doing, not us, right? So I think all of that has to be surfaced for us to do it differently and better. So we're excited to be parents of a disabled person. We're excited to do care work and be cared for, as we will all need care at some point in the life cycle. And we already did if we survived being an infant, right?
That was Jennifer Natalia Fink, a professor of English and Disability Studies at Georgetown University. Her book, All Our Families, Disability Lineage and the Future of Kinship. Thank you so much for your time today.
Thank you so much, Anna.
Coming up, we're speaking with an Ohio mother who started a nonprofit to make home ownership a reality for those with developmental and intellectual disabilities. That's when All Sides continues on 89.7 NPR News.
New from The Embedded podcast. Female athletes have always needed grit and talent. But for decades, they've also needed a certificate.
There was chit-chat about, is that really a woman?
And even now, they're still being checked and questioned. Their story is the newest series from CBC and NPR's Embedded. It's called Tested. Listen wherever you get your podcasts.
You're listening to All Sides. I'm your host, Anna Staver. What will happen to my child when I'm gone? It's a question all parents ask, but it's particularly poignant for parents of adult children with disabilities. Their worry is ever present. Who will care for them, help them navigate services? Even where will they live? Lisa Morrison of Medina County is the mother of three adult children with autism. And she's made it her mission to answer this question, not only for herself, but for all parents of disabled adults. She's the founder of the Integrated Community Solutions and focused on bringing neurodiverse housing to Ohio. Welcome to All Sides, Lisa.
Hi, Anna. Thank you for having me.
Before we talk about your proposed housing project, I want to get your thoughts on what we've been discussing up to this point, this history of institutionalization, of sending people away. What does that concept mean to you as the parent of three adult children with autism?
Well, first of all, I can't even imagine sending my kids away. They are my world. They are my purpose. They are why I do what I do. And they teach me new things every single day. I can't imagine being without them. And I think that that's a sad history. It's a sad history in so many ways for people with differences, that we used to hide them, send them away, not speak of them. And so generations later, as you know, we heard today, people are finding out that they have relatives that they didn't even know existed. So I'm glad that today we are open to people with differences. We embrace them. We try to include them in every way possible. And that just makes a better world today for everybody.
So adults with disabilities really run the spectrum. Some live independently just fine. Some need minimal care. Some need round-the-clock care. So can you talk a little bit about what you're trying to do and the land that you're trying to purchase?
Yes. So we are designing the first community of its kind in Ohio that will be designed for people with developmental disabilities, but it will offer the option of home ownership. And that's a choice that a lot of our families would like to have, but that we don't have. We don't have the choice of our individuals living in a community of their friends while they or their families can build equity in a really important asset. Actually, an asset that might be really useful in later life care. So it's a really important choice. Another unique aspect of our community is that it'll be neurodiverse. So I will live there. My husband will live there. My other families have contacted me and want to live maybe next door to their loved one. So it's a dream of mine to be able to live with my children in a community and have them be my neighbors and still be really involved in their lives. And it's a dream for other families as well. So
And I'm sure it might be a dream for your children because, I mean, everybody's different, but like they may want to live on their own or as independently as they are able to do so. Everybody wants
yeah.
their own space sometimes.
Absolutely. The other thing about our community, though, just to let you know, is that after it's designed and built, we'll have a community center and we will have two different types of day programming available. We will have at least four different vocational programs throughout the community. So a lot of people who live there, when they start their day, will go out and do their jobs or have other programming available. And then other people outside of our community will actually be coming into our community during the day for what we can offer. So, we're not just going to be an isolated enclave. We're going to be very inclusive and have people both within and without of our out of our outside of our community participating daily. So, yeah.
So it's called Autumn Bridge Crossing. How did you pick that
Yes.
name?
Well, first of all, autumn is my family's favorite time of year. We really love the weather. We love the colors. It's just a beautiful, beautiful time of year. And so a bridge crossing kind of symbolizes what our individuals are going to be experiencing living in this community. You're kind of crossing a bridge from dependence to independence. So that's where we came up with the title for Autumn Bridge Crossing, and it really fits.
An Autumn Bridge crossing is the dream, but currently now, I understand that you run a number of free programs like movie nights, card games, yoga, and activities for people of all different abilities.
Absolutely. So we started 2 years ago. When I formed the nonprofit, I wanted to start meeting needs in the community. And I knew that my housing project could take up to 10 years. By the way, we're like 5 years ahead of schedule. So, woo. But I wanted to start meeting the needs of the community. And honestly, with three kids with special needs, I knew that we needed stuff to do at the end of our day. After day programming is done, after people come home from work, et cetera. So we started our social programming. And yes, we meet 2 to 3 times a week, and we have art group and game night, movie night, yoga, et cetera. Anything that I can think to do, I will do. But the other part of our social engagement programming is partnering with other organizations that are serving the community. So for example, recently we partnered with the Office of Older Adults, and groups of our individuals are getting together and shopping for seniors who are unable to leave their homes to shop for themselves. And that has been really successful because it gives our folks, who are the folks who are usually needing assistance, it gives them the opportunity to give back and help others. And it's been a great success. Another example is there's a nonprofit in Medina that has something called the Amazing Race every year to raise money. So for the 3rd year in a row, we're going to be serving lunch to the Amazing Race teams, and that's always a good time too. So yeah, so between our social enrichment programming and our volunteer work, and then we also have life skill development sessions. We had a money 101 session. We had a few cooking classes. So I'm just always trying to think of ways to serve our community and in ways that I can serve them.
It sounds like a really community-focused approach to care for those with differing abilities.
It is. And, having our folks included in the community as much as possible and being helpers within the community too, it just exposes more individuals out there to our population. And that just leads to good things. We tend to fear or be uncomfortable with what we're not familiar with, right? And so just having our folks included as much as possible makes people, more knowing of us, more accepting. It helps people feel more comfortable. And that just leads to all good things for everybody.
How do people find you online if they're listening to this and they think, I would like to get involved with that?
Absolutely. So our website is www.ics-oh.org. And my phone number is 216-280-7755. So, and we also have a very active Facebook page. You can find us on Facebook too. So, yeah.
I want to ask one of the things that we were talking about in this hour, and it is complicated, is that if one of the reasons people or doctors, medical professionals used to push parents towards institutionalization was this idea that it was going to be too hard. It was going to be too hard for the parents. It was going to be too hard for the other siblings. And I was hoping you could talk a little bit about how you navigate things like caregiver burnout. And because it is hard. I mean, I don't think we would want to say that raising a child in any situation isn't hard.
Sure. Well, when we used to tell parents that it was too hard, think about what society in general said. That's what society said. It's too hard. We don't say that anymore. You know, society is very accepting of our children, in many ways, embraces us and wraps their arms around us and helps us, from our doctors to our schools to our, you know, after school care that our adults transition to. There are many, many supports in society now that help us as, you know, as families that are dealing with something a little more unique. And the other thing is, our nonprofit is we're forming a parent resource group. And that's another way that we receive a lot of support, other families, other parents. And when I was raising my kids are now 21, 22, and 23. And I will tell you, it was more difficult than I could have ever imagined. And I was very isolated. I felt very isolated. And, you know, I don't want families to feel that. I know it's hard when you're in the middle of it, in the middle of the most difficult years in your life. It's hard to reach out. But other families, which I didn't realize then, could really form a support network for you in so many ways. They can introduce you to resources they know about. They can emotionally support you. So, you know, I want to start a parent-to-parent group so that we can offer that to our families. I've been really focused on our individuals, and now it's time to kind of branch out and focus a little bit more also on our families and supporting them.
Yeah, and I think it's a recognition, like, I mean, I think we're also getting a lot more honest as a culture about the challenge of being parents, and that it's okay to be like, you know, this is really difficult and it's hard, no matter the abilities of your children.
Absolutely. Absolutely. I think everybody is acknowledging that reality more now. And I think as time goes on, we will just be more open to the difficulty that everybody has, you know, from becoming a brand new parent and learning how to do it to having additional children. There are challenges, and we're recognizing that more now.
Yeah. We're getting down to the end of the hour, but I do want to ask, what do you think people misunderstand most about your children? Or what would you wish that like you could communicate to people when they see somebody who is disabled in public?
So our folks oftentimes are underestimated. So I worked really hard to find employment for my children, and I found them the jobs where they fit well, and everybody embraces them. And some folks are really surprised at how well they're doing. I wasn't. You know, I knew that they could do this. I wouldn't have fought so hard for these things if I didn't know my children could do it. I was speaking with one of my son's supervisors the other day, and I noticed that within their store, they had a lot of individuals with disabilities. And so I was like, you know, I noticed that you hire a lot of our folks, and like, good for you. And, you know, are you doing that because, you know, you just want to give back and give people an opportunity? And she was like, no, they're my best employees. They always show up on time. They never miss a day. They want to work, and they have a lot of pride in their work. And I, you know, I wish I could hire more folks. And so, you know, that really was an eye opener for me, because I thought they were, oh, they're being so kind. But in from her perspective, I need employees like this, and that is why so many folks, you know, that you serve work here. So
It was
I
a
think that
business decision.
it was a business decision, totally. And, I think that just our folks lead full, wonderful lives. They have friendships. They have joy throughout their day. But they also have a lot of capability. So that's what I would want people to realize about our folks.
And one more time, what is the website? How do we find you?
So we are Integrated Community Solutions. We are designing a residential community that will include home ownership for families. And we'll also have homes that could be rental only. So if you are in a situation where you are looking for your loved one's next step in life, considering housing, look us up. We are at ICS-OH.org, or I can be reached at 216-280-7755. And the last thing I want to say is that our social programs are open to all of any ability. So join us.
That was Lisa Morrison, the founder of Integrated Community Solutions. Thank you so much for your time today.
Thank you so much for having me.
And thank you all for listening to All Sides on 89.7 NPR News.